So we're continuing with the parasha, and much to our surprise, when Yehuda discovers that Tamar is pregnant, Yehuda says, "Otziuha v'tisareif, take her out and brand her." In ancient times, when a woman was discovered to be a woman of ill repute, they would brand her. They take some kind of hot iron and put it on her forehead, and she'd walk around with that sign for life. And that was like, okay, now we know who you are, so we, at least, you know, no one's going to make a mistake. So, Hotziyuha v'tisareif, first of all, simply means, if that's the way of life she's chosen, okay, so then she should have at least the sign, so no one else should get confused and take her for a good shidduch for the top children of the time, right? So that's the simple reading, Hotziyuha v'tisareif. And Yehuda, at that time and at that location, Yehuda had a position of leadership and authority. He had a responsibility. He was like the governor of the town. So although the brothers didn't hold Yehuda in as high regard, but everyone around him did. So in his town, he was in charge of the law and order. And so Yehuda says, okay, if that's what we're coming up with, that she's not faithful, she's become a woman of ill repute, so then, okay, we'll do with her like our law says we do with all women of ill repute. That was their law in Canaan, or in that part of Canaan at the time. So that's one understanding of Hotziyuha v'tisareif, which at least makes it a little bit more gentle, right? It's still pretty harsh to have a mark on their forehead, right? But, okay, but that's a little easier than burning. But if we're going to go with the interpretation that our sages say, take her out and burn her. So then we have to understand what's going on here. We'll continue in 5 seconds. Okay. So going with the traditional interpretation that our sages said, Hotziyuha v'tisareif, take her out and she should be burned. So we have to understand that prior to the receipt of the Torah, so one of the Noahide laws is that you have to have a legal system. And that legal system is left to the hands of the society. So long as it is a logical legal system, it's in the hands of the society. The society at that time had rules. And the rules were not so far from the Torah rules. For example, if a woman's husband died without children, they had a rule that she was to be wed by the brother, Yibum. And if the second brother died without kids, and she was to be wed to the third brother. Now, in the laws of the time, she could be wed to a brother or to another relative. We find a similar custom in the story of Ruth, right? It's not real Yibum. Ruth's husband passes away without kids, and there's no brother left, and so the cousin marries her. That's not Yibum. But you see this idea of a woman staying in the family and helping her build the family, and she should still be a part of the family. That was a custom back then. Now, we can understand this if we look a little bit more deeply. We can understand this as a great kindness to the woman. You go to other societies of the time, a woman's husband died, she's left childless, she's a widow. In crass terms, we'd say she's used goods. No one wants to marry her. Financially, it's a man's world. Remember, women back then were illiterate. They didn't know math. It was practically impossible for a woman to manage financially on her own. Even though in Judaism it was possible, because Judaism actually protects a woman's rights. A woman is entitled to own land. A woman is not allowed to be cheated. A woman is trusted in many things. So women had extraordinary rights if you compare the times. If a woman has a claim against a man, she could take him to court. You won't find another society at that time that had that, to the best of my knowledge. So these were extraordinary things. Remember, it's only the last century that women in the United States were allowed to own land, right? In the 1800s, women were not allowed to own land in the United States either. Okay? Check. You got the whole internet at the touch of a finger. Go check. At what date were women entitled to own land in the United States of America? Check. So this idea that a woman stays in the family is a gift to the woman. At the same time, in those days, society would also enforce it. That if a woman went and married outside the family, it was considered like adultery. So it's not what the Torah says, meaning by Torah law, if a woman lost her husband without children and then went and married someone else, so we say it's a transgression on her behalf, but no death penalty, no punishment. Meaning we don't get involved, we say it's between her and God, it's not the right thing to do, but it's her business, we don't get involved. But in those days, the custom was different. And being that the story is taking place prior to the receipt of the Torah, so then society is bound by the laws of society, like a regular Noahide society. So when Yehuda says, oh, she's found to be pregnant, then she gets the death penalty. What Yehuda is saying is a ruling based on the norms of that time, not based on the Torah. There's no such halacha in the Torah. There's no witnesses, there's no warning, she wasn't the married woman, nothing. But that was their custom, and that was the accepted custom of the time, and so that was the binding custom of the time. It could be that Yehuda, as the relative, was the one who was supposed to give the ruling. It could be that Yehuda, as the head of the town, was the one who was supposed to give the ruling. But either way, Yehuda gives this ruling. So far, are we answering your questions, Mr. Brownstein? We're okay? Okay, it happens to be you asked excellent questions, and these questions are addressed some by the Talmud and some by the commentaries on the Torah, the Rishonim. You have, I'm not making up what I'm telling you. Just got to look in a few sources and you'll see it. So, although technically what Tamar did was in line with the custom, because Tamar went with her father-in-law, she was supposed to stay in the family, she did. But Yehuda doesn't know that. So Tamar is now being summoned to be executed, and she knows that the only man she's been with is Yehuda. So Tamar is tempted to say, tell Yehuda he's the father. And she has proof of it, right? But Tamar does not say that. Tamar says, before you take me out to be killed, I would like Yehuda to examine the evidence. I have over here, and she goes to bring out the cape, the signet ring, the staff. I have over here evidence who fathered these children. Ask Yehuda if he could please recognize this evidence. Now the words that Tamar uses are, if you have a Tanakh in front of you, haker no. Could you please recognize? Go back a chapter in the Torah, and we find those same two words. Haker no. Where do we find it? When the brothers bring the bloodied garment to Yaakov Avinu, they present him with the garment and say, Haker no. Recognize, please, Father, is this the garment? So behaker, the Talmud says, using those two words, biseret aviv, he gave his father word about what's doing with his son, vebehaker bisruhu, and he was also given tiding with the same words. And in truth, Chazal tell us, this is the closing of a full cycle. Chazal say, because of what the brothers did to Yosef, Yehuda lost his wife and his two children. So the Torah attests to the children's sins and why they deserve to die. But our sages say that Yehuda could have saved Yosef. He did not save Yosef. He saved him from death, but he sold him to slavery. And as such, he ended up burying his wife and his two children. Chazal say that's one of the understandings as to why this parasha is juxtaposed. This story is going to take 20 years, the whole story of Yehuda getting married, having children. Why did the Torah go over to that story suddenly? The Torah is telling you the end of the story on one end. You want to know what happened to the brothers who sold Yosef? So here's part of the story. There's more, but the Torah doesn't bother telling us about the other brothers. The Torah just takes the head, takes Yehuda, tells you what happened to Yehuda. So far we're all together? Okay. The Talmud says, that there's an angel in heaven for Esav, right? And who's going to take down Amalek and Esav? The descendants of Yehuda through Tamar, right? King David is a descendant through Tamar. So the Talmud says that when Tamar went to give the signs to Yehuda, Esav's angel came and took them all away. And suddenly they're not where she thought they were. So again, you want to read the Talmud in simplistic terms? That means the angel came and they disappeared. You want to read it in Maimonides' approach? So that means that as luck would have it, she went to the closet where she thought she left it and it wasn't there. And now she's saying, hey, give me just a second, I have something, but 1 second, it's not where I thought it was. And this isn't the time she wants to have misplaced it, right? And Chazal say, this is a product of, in heaven, this is Esav's angels doing. And so Gabriel, our angel, steps up to the plate and says, no, you don't. And he brings them back, and Tamar finds them, and she sends it to Yehuda. So this pious woman, who's risking her life, she doesn't know it, but she's pregnant with twins. She's risking 3 lives. And she will not embarrass Yehuda publicly. She doesn't say, he's the father. She says, please ask him if he recognizes whose these are. Because this is the guy who it was. So they bring the items to Yehuda. She was already being escorted to the gallows. They're preparing the fire and she's being escorted. He mutzeit. She was already being taken out. So she had no guarantee. Are they going to listen to me? Are they going to wait to hear Yehuda's response? She's being taken out to get the death penalty. And she doesn't say. But wait, she might die. Right? From here we learn a phenomenal rule. The Talmud says, Mutav lo le'adam, she'yapil atzmo le'kivshan ha'esh. A person is better off throwing himself into a burning furnace rather than Asher she'albin pnei chavero berabim, rather than embarrassing his friend publicly. You're better off throwing yourself into a furnace. So you see, Chazal viewed Tamar's acts as though she was throwing herself into the furnace. She could have stopped it. And she was letting the train keep going. And it's moving, and she doesn't have control. She could have taken control, but she didn't. And Chazal blame her. Chazal say it's as though she would have thrown herself into the furnace. If she would have died, it would have been her fault, and she would have been right. Here we learn how careful Chazal wanted us to be, how careful the Torah wanted us to be about embarrassing our fellow man. Can I tell you a story? It was my first month on the job. Not here. At a different place. Okay, we won't mention where. It wasn't here, no. And some students started doing a little bit of shenanigans. And we're in the middle of class, and suddenly one student takes a toffee and throws it across the class at the other one. And these aren't little kids, these are adults. You're talking about people who are older than me.
What?
I'm teaching a class of adults. And one of the adults takes a toffee and throws it at the other one. Okay. I don't know what to make of it. Like a little bit shocked. We have a break in between classes. And one of the administrators comes to me and tells me, you saw that? I said, yeah, I did. He says to me, you got to understand, before you came to teach this class, so there's a history to this class. These adults have been coming to this class for a decade. Up until half a decade ago, they were doing this every class. And then half a decade ago, we brought in a new teacher who was tough as nails, and he stopped it. Now, you're the new teacher on the block, and they're testing you. And if you don't react harshly, you're going to lose the class again, and half the class is going to leave. Half the class left when these shenanigans happened. And they're trying you, they're testing you. And if you don't get up in the beginning of next class and tell them, I will not have this, you have to understand that you run the risk of losing the class. Boom. I'm on the first month on the job. And they're telling me you have to stand up to this. Okay. I heard him. I said, okay, I want to think about it. I have another 5 minutes. I didn't have another 5 minutes because there was a line of adults waiting for me on the way to class, and each one's telling me, if you don't put a stop to this, we're leaving the class. So now I walk back in and I have to start class again, and everyone's sitting there looking at me, waiting for me to say something. So I'm sitting there and I say, 1 second. I stop to think for a minute. And I said, you know, maybe I should tell him something. The man's old enough to be my father, but he is doing something pretty silly in the middle of class. So I remembered this Gemara. The Gemara says, better throw yourself into a furnace than embarrass someone publicly. He's wrong. You shouldn't be throwing candy in the middle of class. But am I 100% sure, when I'm new on the job, and I don't know him well enough, and I don't know the guy he threw it at well enough, and I don't have a complete handle. Everyone's pressuring me to embarrass him publicly, right? I had a line of people waiting for me as I walked back to class, and each one's telling me, I'm going to leave the class if you don't put a stop to it right away. And I told everyone, wait, I want to think, right? So I decided, it could be I'll get fired, and it could be I'm messing up the class, but it could be I'm embarrassing someone publicly, and it's wrong. And Chazal said, better throw yourself into a furnace than embarrass someone publicly. So I decided, and it was a risk. I'm telling you, I was telling myself, Rabbon Shalom, help me here. I don't know what I'm supposed to do, but I'm not going to embarrass him publicly because of this Gemara. So I didn't say anything. Like I let it ride, and we finished class. And when I leave class, for the next hour and a half, I have people holding me up, lecturing me about how I better put a stop to this, or within 2 weeks there will be no class, no one's showing up.
Did it happen again?
Didn't happen again. So, okay, I get all these lectures and I walk home. I come to the house, and on my way home, I pass by this guy's house, and I said to myself, maybe I should stop in and talk to him now. I said, okay, I'm not stopping in. I want to think about it. I come home, and he's standing at my door. He's standing there waiting for me. So now, I'm really wondering what I'm supposed to do. You know, he's here. Maybe I should tell him something. So he's standing there with his wife, and I don't want to say anything in front of his wife. And I smile. Didn't say anything. So he says, I wanted to come here and thank you. It's been a whole month. And your classes are amazing. I love them so much. You're changing my life. I brought a special bottle of wine for you. Because the classes, I feel like they're changing my life. And I'm standing there biting my nails, like thinking, you know, I was about to tell him, listen here, better drop out of class, but don't do this to the class. You're going to cause 50 people to stop learning Torah. Don't do this. And I'm not saying anything. I'm just listening, smiling patiently, listening as he's saying, and I'm thinking, like, how do I lead this conversation where it's got to go? After he talks, then he's like all excited and happy and shiny and rosy. So I found a nice way to tell him. I said, you know, it's a funny thing about this class. These guys are so serious. I don't know. Maybe they're all yuckies like me. I don't get it. On my way here, you notice it took me an hour and a half after class to get home. He says, yeah, I've been standing here waiting for you for a half hour. I said, yeah, so think about it. You know why it took me an hour and a half? Because when I left class, there were so many people standing in line telling me, they're going to leave the class over one candy. What'd you do? You threw one candy. You know how excited people got over one candy? But you know what? It's a funny thing. It's not one person. There's a whole line as I left class. Each one's telling me they're going to leave, and I'm not sure what to do. He says to me, really? People take it so seriously? I said, yeah, you know, I'm new here. I'm here only a month, but this is what people are telling me. So he says, I promise you, you will never again see a candy thrown in your class. I promise you, have my word, never again. I'm not throwing another candy. End of story. Now, the story has a nice ending, but I didn't know how it would end. At the time, I thought I might lose the position. I'm there all of a month, and everyone's telling me this is over. Once he started throwing candies, your class is over. He's not going to stop, and now the other guy's going to throw back, and that's it. We know what the scene looks like. I didn't know, but I knew this rule. Chazal took it very seriously when Chazal said, better throw yourself into a furnace than embarrass someone publicly. So I said, I don't know what I'm supposed to do here, but I know what I'm not supposed to do here. I better find another solution because I don't know the scene well enough. I can't embarrass him publicly. Like I can't.
Kamsa Bar Kamsa, yeah.
Oh, very nice. Yes.
What prostitutes publicly?
It's a good question. I don't have a proof to say one way or another. I would think three people is publicly, but I don't have a proof for that. I'd
three
have to look.
People watching?
That's what I would think, but again, I don't have proof for that. I don't have proof for that. I don't know. I gotta look. It's I'm giving a guess. I hope it's educated, but it's a guess. I'd have to look. I don't know. Yeah.
Based off of what we're talking about, being embarrassing people, public, etc. I saw this thing on Facebook now. Someone put it on there. It's about the publicizing names of child molesters in the Orthodox community. As far as letting know who these people are, etc. I mean, I guess it's embarrassing to them, but maybe it's also a warning to parents out there: don't let these guys around your kids, sort of thing. Does that fall in that category?
That's why I kept mentioning that I also didn't have the full picture here, because we do have a concept that sometimes a person made the problem for himself. I was once in a yeshiva where I was robbed and a lot of people were robbed. And then the thief was caught. And it turned out he robbed hundreds of people. When I came in line, the police wanted me to identify my passport that he stole, my checkbook that he stole, and a whole bunch of other things. So I met there, like half the city was there. Like there was a line going out the door. There's so many people he robbed. So a few months later, I see him back in yeshiva. So I put up a sign that says, someone who has been caught as a thief has been seen around yeshiva, be careful with your goods. And other people came up and said, how could you do that? You're embarrassing him. Maybe he did tshuva. I said, I don't think that I have to worry about that. Even if he did tshuva, that's part of the price he pays. They didn't agree with me. So we took it, we went to a Rav, and he said 100%. Even if the guy did tshuva, that's part of the price of the sin. We have to be careful, and we have to warn other people to be careful. There is a price for a certain behavior. You can't say, now I have to be stupid and ignore the problem. The person has proven himself to be a danger to society, and you have to warn people. Hopefully, he won't continue being in danger. But I don't know the story, but I'm saying, so there is such a concept that sometimes the person did it to himself, and that was a little bit of my doubt in that story, because the guy did do it to himself. It is unacceptable in the middle of a class to throw candy at someone else. So that's why I saw the angle they were presenting, and that's why I said that because I felt I didn't have a clear enough picture of the history and the person and what was going on, I didn't feel I had a right. And if I don't have a right, even though he's in the wrong, I'm playing with fire, because Chazal say you'd rather throw yourself into fire than embarrass someone. That's why I said that part of the story too. That if I had known that he was in the wrong and I had known everything else, then part of running a class is that you sometimes say, no, I'm sorry, that's not acceptable. And the fact that the guy might be embarrassed because you said it, well, he did it to himself. So there is that concept too. That sometimes you have no choice. They put you in the spot where you have to answer publicly. That's true. And then the same would hold true with a person who is a child molester. I would just be a little bit careful that you have to know what you're talking about, because there was at least a decade. I'd like to think that it finished. I don't know. But I know that for about a decade, this was the in thing. When people were upset at someone, they'd put out rumors that the guy was a child molester. This was one of the ways of ruining people's reputations. And more than one person I know was blacklisted illegitimately, where the court, the secular court, threw it out of court. Like they said, this is ridiculous. There's nothing, no grounds whatsoever here for the rumors that were spread about people. But that doesn't undo the harm that was done. I'm saying people lost their reputations, people lost their standing, and very few people hear when a person's name is cleared. So you just got to be careful if you're going to do that. Yeah.
Would it be considered public shaming if you just said objectively, no throwing candies, no shenanigans?
You have to gauge, in the scenario. Again, ordinarily, under normal circumstances, one of your responsibilities as a teacher is to say, no, you can't do that here. And that's legitimate. And the fact that the guy did something stupid, that's the price they pay for doing something stupid. You know, no one asked them to throw candy in the middle of class. But then when you factor that maybe there's more at play, and maybe there are better ways of accomplishing it, and then that you would not be permitted to embarrass him publicly if you could have accomplished the same thing in a peaceful way, and that's, it proved itself. You see, in this case, I don't know what would have happened had I protested in class. Maybe I would have lost everything. I'm not sure what would have happened because we didn't play it out that way. But you also better know what you're doing. You got to remember you're playing with fire when you risk embarrassing someone publicly. Yeah?
Are Beit Din's public?
Are Beit Din's public? I think so. Again, that goes back to his question.
But that would be the answer, is that if somebody does something that's a crime, like it's ruled in a Beit Din, then it becomes public knowledge and you're not embarrassing them publicly.
Okay. Answer your own comment.
That is, what do you mean?
If we learn it from Tamar, and Tamar could have said it's Yehuda's fault because he impregnated me, then it certainly seems to indicate that it's not enough, right? And that was in court, and Tamar was just clearing her own name. So that teaches us something a little bit to the contrary, right? She could have cleared her name, she was risking her own life, but she said, no, not at the cost of embarrassing him publicly. Okay? So, you see, even though, I don't know if I'd say he was in the wrong, but it certainly seems that way, right? You see, what did he say? Tzadika mimeni. She's more right than I am, right? Yehuda admits, and that's part of the greatness of Yehuda, that he does admit. You know, that's the greatness of the whole Yehuda family, Yehuda and David, etc. Okay.
She put out those things because she wanted him to identify it, so she could have her life saved. So she could have said nothing at all. She could have.
Right.
She was really, really that concerned. Embarrassing or not embarrassing, she could have kept her mouth shut altogether and went straight to the fire, and that had been it. She put that stuff out there because she wanted him to say it.
Right.
It's kind of in a way she wanted to embarrass himself to save her life.
Yeah, but okay, so take the next step. What does that teach us? That's what we were discussing earlier. Judaism gives us balance. It's not the extreme, you could call this extreme, I definitely see the extreme piety in it, but it's not the extreme of let me die but not embarrass him even though he's in the wrong. It's not the other side which I would have thought was balanced if Chazal didn't tell me otherwise, and that is, he did it, let me just say he did it. No, it's teaching us there's an extreme level of piety to have that concern for someone else, and that's considered pious, but not to the point of dying, to the point of let him have a chance of, let him have a chance. He can free me. And she does tell him, ha care no, please do recognize. She's telling him, you know, my life's in your hands. Please do recognize. So, Yehuda sees it, and he says, Sadika, she is right. Mimeni. The kids are mine. Tzedekah, she is right. And our sages say, you put a pause here, and a heavenly voice is the one calling out and saying, Mimeni, it's all my doing. So that goes back to our discussion in the previous class, that Chazal saw this whole story as one of the few cases in the Torah or in the Tanakh where God says this has to play itself out this way. We said, Adam in the Garden of Eden, was God saying this has to play itself out this way, and this is another story where, according to our tradition, this was God's doing. V'lo yasaf od ledata, what does that mean? So the simple reading is, he did not continue. But the word yasaf could also mean to stop. And so our sages say it means he didn't stop from knowing her. He wed her legally, and she was his legally married wife. So she has twins, etc. And now we're back to Yosef, Chamishi. We're back to Yosef. So, Yosef is taken down to Egypt. He's purchased, as we discussed, by Potiphar, the chief executioner, one of the most important men in Egypt. And Yosef, we could say, is the classical Jew, where he applies his brains, he applies his honesty, he applies his mathematical skills, he applies his charisma, his gentile, his humility, and he makes Potiphar successful. Everything's working right. And once Yosef is in charge, everything goes right. Chazal say, Shalosh smuchotim, there are three things that we say follow one another almost directly. One is, if you hire a tzaddik in your house, almost directly you'll see blessing from it. You see, he hired Yosef, things go right. And Yosef's in charge of everything except for Potiphar's wife. Yosef's in charge of everything. He starts taking care of himself. Starts taking care of his hair. Starts taking care of his clothing. His father's sitting in Canaan, crying over him, praying over him, mourning over him. And he's sitting in Egypt, taking good care of himself. One opinion in the commentaries is that Yosef didn't know whose side his father was on. Meaning his father sent him to the brothers as the brothers jumped on him and got rid of him. So according to one opinion in the commentaries, Yosef spent the next 20 years wondering, what was Dad's position in all of this? Did he also think I should be kicked out of the house? You know, Grandpa Avram kicked Ishmael out of the house. So maybe Dad also thought I should be out. So Yosef's going to spend the 20 years without sending a letter to Yaakov. He's not so sure where he stands in Yaakov's eyes. That's one understanding over here. So Yosef is starting to take care of himself. And so God says, oh, you're having such a good time? Let me help you. You know, that's the way life works, right? If we start behaving like everything's great, everything's perfect, so then, oh, so I need another challenge, okay? So another challenge comes our way. Life never goes smooth for too long, as the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, Al titiesh minapur anut. Don't assume all your troubles are over. They're never over. Or as the Talmud says, Ad zibula basraisa. Until the last cloud of earth is on your grave, you shouldn't finish praying. Meaning, it ain't over till that last cloud of earth. That's what the Talmud says. So, back to our story. So, Potiphar's wife, a very pious woman, she looks in the stars, and she sees that from Yosef is supposed to come the Messiah, and she's supposed to have a hand in it. She looks at this beautiful young man in their house, gorgeous, young teenager, huge muscles, genteel, and she starts trying to seduce him. So every day, she grabs him and begs him and does everything she can. And he says, no. And she says, yes. And she says, yes. He says, no. And this is going on every time she can get him. And she'd always bring him in to do work on her behalf. And she'd promise him things and nothing budging. And she'd tell him, you know, if you come with me, you know how much I'll give you. You know how good life will be for you. Nothing moving. Finally, she says to him, you know, I'm going to punish you if you don't do it. Nothing doing. She says, I'm going to have you put in jail. He says, God takes care of jails. She says, I'm going to take out your eyes. I'm going to have my husband take out your eyes. He says, God gives sight. She says, you know, I'm going to have you crippled. He says, God's the one that gives us the capacity to walk. Now, there's brilliance in this answer. Meaning, very often, if a person's faced with a challenge, Yosef could have found a legal loophole. He could have said, wait a second, her husband's a eunuch. What kind of marriage is this? Technically, she's not married anymore. So, if she wants to sleep with Yosef, Yosef could say, what's wrong? Yosef doesn't look for loopholes. Because Yosef keeps remembering there's one boss in this world and it ain't me. And he's the one that gives me the capacity to walk and to see. And this is one of the greatest lessons of life. We find loopholes in life. We like to find excuses. I'll tell you, there was a man, Conrad, what's his name? Not Conrad. Oh. Seven Habits of Highly Successful People. What's his name?
Sure.
Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. I'll have it in a second. So,
Franklin Covey? No.
Yeah. Stephen S. Covey, yeah. Stephen S. Covey. So he writes in his book, he says, look at Yosef for a minute. He's not Jewish, by the way. Christian. But it's an insight worth noting because it's a correct insight. Yosef is... He just passed away this year. Stephen S. Covey. Yosef is in Potiphar's house. Life's turned on him, right? He could have said God turned on him. His brothers turned on him. Maybe his dad turned on him. Everything's gone wrong. So Yosef could say, I've had it with life. Why should I live this ethical, correct life? Why? What am I getting out of it? That I'm a slave? My brothers are living in the lap of luxury, and where am I? So I was ethical, I was nice, I was right, and where'd it get me? Yosef doesn't do that. Yosef doesn't cheat his boss. What would happen if he put a few dollars in his pocket? Who would know? What would happen if Yosef would go off with his boss's wife every so often? Who would know? Now, the word saris, we keep interpreting it as a eunuch, but we have to know that there's a machlokas rishonim. Meaning Rav Sadia Gaon and others, in their commentary on the book of Daniel, they say the word saris doesn't always mean eunuch. Saris would be any officer in the king's court. Many officers who came in contact with the king's wives were eunuchs, and then that became the general name for officers. So the Medrash Tanhuma learns that Potiphar was fertile. He wasn't a eunuch. And so Potiphar's wife tells Yosef, what's wrong? I'll get pregnant. They'll think it's his boy. What do you care? Yosef, no, I'm a married woman. And every day she's chasing after him. And Yosef is a young man. He's got the normal hormones of young men. And what's to keep him from doing what's wrong? One thing. There is a God. And she says, you know, I'm going to take out your eyes. You're going to live the rest of your life blind. She could do it. But if Yosef is willing to admit there's a God and he runs the world, then that's what will hold him in line. And if there is no God, so let me do what I want. Come on, what's wrong? Can life get any worse? He's already been bought to be raped by his boss, right? That was the intent of purchasing Yosef. So think of Yosef. He's on the slave market. The boss comes in, looks at his beautiful curls, looks at his muscles, says, I'll buy that young man. And Yosef knows what he was purchased for. So what type of life should Yosef lead? If Yosef looks at life, he could say, God turned on me. Why shouldn't I turn on him, right? I wanted a different life. God didn't give me the life I wanted. I had potential. God didn't give me that. So sometimes in life, we're very tempted to do that. We're tempted to look at life and say, God, if you wanted me to do what's right, why didn't you do what's right for me, right? I know what I want. You didn't give me what I wanted. So why should I, so to speak, give you what you wanted? But no. The brilliance in Yosef is the honesty. Yosef says, I know there is a God, and I know He runs the world. I don't know why He put me here. I don't know why I have to suffer like this, but I do know that He controls the world, so I'm going to behave. And Yosef is tempted. Chazal say, it's not that Yosef looked at her and said, what an ugly woman, I don't want to have anything to do with you. The exact opposite is true. Yosef would turn away, and she'd say, why aren't you looking at me? And he said, because I'm not supposed to look at you. So Chazal say, she had a necklace put on Yosef with a little knife jutting out of it. So Yosef could no longer put his head down when she spoke to him. So she'd come to Yosef and say, now you're going to have to look at me. And Yosef would still try to find a way to turn away or close his eyes. And so she's doing everything she can to pounce on Yosef. And you read the Torah and you think the story's over after Yosef's been incarcerated. Our tradition is that for every day for the next 10 years, she visited him in jail. She found a way in and continued trying to seduce him for the next 10 years. So Yosef stands up to this test not only one day, and not only when he's in his master's home. Now it gets worse. He stood up to the test. She grabbed him by the cloak. Everyone's out at the Nile. No one's going to know. There's no one around the house but a little baby who can't talk for the life of him. There's a little baby there in the crib and no one else is around. She grabs his coat. He pulls away. She grabs harder. He slips out of the coat, runs out without any clothing. He's out in the street totally naked. Now he's got nothing to wear. What's he supposed to do? She starts yelling. Everyone comes running in. She starts yelling. She says, look at what that guy did to me. Look. Now he's caught naked out in the street. Doesn't look too good, right? She's fully clothed. He's naked. So she holds on to the robe so that when the master comes home, she says, look, you know. Now she's smart. She doesn't just do that. She waits till they're in bed that night. And when they're being intimate, she says, you know, where your hands now, that's where his hands were. When you're doing everything he does, she starts telling him, Yosef tried to do that too. She knows exactly how to tick Potiphar off. So Potiphar goes wild. Potiphar brings Yosef in. He gets the whipping boys ready. He brings in a court. He summons in the elders of Egypt. The priests of Egypt sit there and look. And we have two interesting midrashim. Midrash number one says, the priests actually asked Yosef, what's your version of the story? So Yosef says, she wanted to sin, and I tried to run away. And that's why I ended up in the street like that. And Potiphar's blood's boiling, and his wife is yelling there at Yosef, and the priests say, can we examine the garment? They give them the garment. They say, look, if her version of the story is true, then he was trying to advance, and she was pulling the cloak away. So the front seams of the cloak should be frayed, because this was a serious fight, right? He's trying to attack her, so she's pushing him away, and he's pushing at the cloak, and then she yells and he runs, right? If his version of the story is true, then she's trying to pull him by the cloak, but he's pulling his neck against the cloak. Then the back of the cloak should be frayed because that's where his neck was pushing against the cloak. They check the seams, and Yosef's version of the story comes true. They say, Mr. Potiphar, we're very sorry to tell you, but the cloak proves Yosef's right. That's one version. And according to that version, that's why we find at the end of the book of Bereishis, at the end of Genesis, when Yosef becomes king, he absolves the priests of all taxes. He says, I'm not touching their land, they're not taxed. He gives them back, you know. They were honest. They judged a fair trial. There's another version that's quoted in the Medrash that says that baby, that 3-4-month-old baby that couldn't talk, suddenly started talking and said, wait, I want to talk. So everyone looked down, since when do you know how to talk? So the kid says, I was here and I saw what happened. And Yosef's telling the truth. So now everyone's dumbfounded. What's going on? This tiny baby talking. So that's a medrash, right? You could take that medrash for whatever it's worth. I mean, obviously it's worth. The question is that medrash to be taken literally, etc.? Yes?
There's a couple questions. One, if she wanted Yosef so badly, then what was the point of throwing him in jail? Is it just she felt that maybe she had better access to him or something? I mean, well, what's the point if she's constantly trying to get at him? Or is she just frustrated and she just lost her cool at the moment and said, that's it, this guy's pissing me off, and you know, I'm going to show him his mistake. My second question is, you know, we just talked about publicly embarrassing somebody. So why didn't Yosef just say, instead of saying, no, this is what really happened, to be like Tamar and just say, well, you know, you guys decide, I don't know, say something else. But he stood up for himself and publicly was willing to embarrass her to defend himself.
So for the first question, it's possible one of a few options. So his first question was, remind me again.
Why throw him in jail? She's trying to get
why was she throwing him in jail? Right. So, if we're going with the Medrash Tanhuma, that she kept bugging him in jail, so then maybe she'll teach him a lesson. She'll have him punished, and then maybe he'll give in. Don't forget that Egypt was a land where everyone was sleeping with everyone. Meaning, people didn't know which child was theirs and which was the neighbor's. You know, women were sleeping with women, men were sleeping with men, and people were sleeping with one another's wives. You see that later on in the Torah and in the prophets as well. So it could be she thought she'd have better access. It could be she thought she'd punish him, she'd get away with it. It could be she got fed up with him. She had a moment of weakness in that sense. And it could be that she had a serious threat on her hands now. He's running out naked into the public square. You know, what are people going to say? Well, you know, this isn't going to go by quietly. And it could be that she wanted to preclude. She couldn't know what he would do next. So she wanted to preclude his next move. With regards to your second question, I think there are many possible answers. But because I never thought of it before, I don't want to be quick to answer. I want to think about it some more. Meaning, I think there's room to discern between the stories, whereas the story of Yehuda and Tamar, technically what happened was legally okay. The story of Yosef and Potiphar's wife was a situation where she was trying to commit adultery. I'm saying there is room to discern between the stories, but I never thought of that question, so I want to think about it. I don't want to be quick to answer. It's food for thought. I'd rather we get back to that. In a day or two. Yeah. A subtle hint. What can you do? Nachum and I were learning together long before you guys came here. Of course I want him back. Yes?
I don't know how off-topic this question is about Midrashim. So I heard a Midrash that before the flood, there were no seasons. And then there was another Midrash that I heard that there were seasons, and how Adam was getting more and more scared, how the days were getting shorter. They contradict.
Okay. In a nutshell, Midrashim can have different opinions, right? If you want, we could look at the verse and see what they're arguing about. But yeah, the Midrashim don't always go one line. Sometimes there are different opinions, and sometimes they're complementary. But that deserves a discussion on a Thursday night, maybe later tonight. We'll get to it. Yeah?
Is it not somewhat unusual that Potiphar didn't have Yosef executed instead of thrown in prison? Perhaps maybe like realized his righteousness to an extent and had some sort of doubt about the story? That obviously up until now, as you were saying, Yosef didn't do anything wrong in the house, and Yosef himself defends himself by saying it's good for Potiphar while he was there, etc., etc. So surely this hasn't gone unnoticed. Maybe he would be skeptical a little bit, maybe?
So Chazal actually point out what you're saying. I mean, it's an excellent point. The commentaries say that it's also unusual that Potiphar enrolls him in a 5-star hotel. He puts him in the royal prison. You know, this isn't the dungeon. This is the prison where you actually get royal treatment. So our sages, based on this, our sages say that Potiphar really sensed that Yosef was in the right and his wife was in the wrong. And so Potiphar actually was in a bind. What's he supposed to do? He's going to let Yosef walk scot-free, so then how could he continue living with this woman? He's going to put Yosef in jail, but Yosef didn't do anything wrong. Yosef's his faithful servant. So he found the middle ground. He said, I have to put him in jail to protect my wife's honor. I'll put him in the best jail there is. So I'll at least have it good. So that's right. That's what the commentaries point out because of that question, right?
If he had it so good, why was it a punishment to wait? Like after there was the baker and the servant, the winemaker.
Right.
He said, like, remember me.
We'll get there. It's a good question. We'll get back to that, God willing, in a few minutes.